The Fantasy Animation Podcast is a completely independent production. It is made by experts in the field. Chris is a lecturer in liberal arts and visual cultures education at King's College London and author of The Computer Animated Film, available in all good bookshops. And I, Alex that is, am a senior lecturer in film and media studies at the University of Portsmouth and author of Encountering the Impossible, the Fantastic in Hollywood Fantasy Cinema, available in even better bookshops. We do this podcast to provide audiences with an informative and hopefully entertaining guide through the ways in which you can not only enjoy fantasy and animation, but study it, examine it, explore it, and of course, make it and have a career in it. I hope you enjoy the show. Hello again, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Fantasy Animation Podcast. I'm Alex Sargent.
And I'm Chris Holliday.
And it's a yabba dabba doozy today, Chris. We're
unbelievable. Unbelievable start to the podcast. This is 30 seconds in.
All academic pretension thrown out the window. Hey, we're doing the Flintstones, and I'm very excited about it. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. It feels like a seminal piece of animation television, but also a text rife with fantastical notes that I'm really keen for us to talk about. Listeners may remember we vaguely talked about this back on our 100th episode, where we talked about the 100th episode of the Flintstones, but we have never really got our teeth into this kind of, you know, colossal cultural behemoth of a thing, so it's fun to do that today. Chris, any immediate thoughts on why it's exciting to be talking about the Flintstones?
Well, it's always exciting to be talking about the Flintstones, I guess, and this is, again, as you said, one of the ones that we could have done sooner. I'm pleased that we finally got a chance to do it. I've got notes on kind of sound. I think kind of sound design and voice work are really interesting in the Flintstones. Also serial narratives. Flintstones is often something that I've put into stuff that I'm writing in like a sentence about, oh yeah, and then the Flintstones is really important. And actually it'd be really good to sort of unpack that with a little bit more sort of scope. So yeah, stuff on sound, stuff on serial narratives, and yeah, I guess we will use and mine our special guest's mind, who is definitely more informed than we are on this topic, that's for sure.
Speaking of special guests, we are very delighted to be joined today by Dr. Jared Bahir Broche, who is an assistant teaching professor in critical sports studies at the... He says, not getting the right page up. At the University of Colorado Boulder. His teaching title might suggest the astonishing sort of range of work that Jared has done in their career. They specialize in issues connecting to political economies of the media, but they also examine issues of representation connecting to ownership and policy in popular culture. And this means that Jared has a number of publications, including Hanna-Barbera, A History, published by Macfarlane Press in 2021, but has also written lots of stuff on animation, sport, and globalization more broadly in a variety of academic books and peer-reviewed articles. So first of all, Jared, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. I mean, anytime I get to talk about the Flintstones and Hanna-Barbera, it's a good day. So thanks for having me on.
We are of sound and like mind. This is good to hear. Yep. Right. So, Jared, given your various research interests, I guess the first question I have for you is what circumstances transpired that made you want to write a book about the Flintstones? And what was it you wanted to say about the Flintstones that you hopefully ended up saying in that book to help us get started?
So as a PhD student, I knew I wanted to research animation, especially the economics of it and how it reflects our larger society. And honestly, I got tired of reading about Disney. And I knew kind of the impact Hanna-Barbera had made on my childhood and the influence and the massive amount of hours people had watched their shows on Saturday morning in the US and around the world. And so I felt like it was an overlooked company, and particularly the Flintstones. I mean, as The Simpsons enters what seems like its 150th season, we still see that influence today, but we kind of overlook that impact and really kind of the conventions it led to in adult television animation.
I suppose just jumping off of that, actually, the idea of the adult, I think the Flintstones, certainly looking at your book on Hanna-Barbera, and the introduction kind of takes us through this forgotten status, or not forgotten status, but maybe underrepresented critically in terms of Hanna-Barbera, their status within sort of critical discourse. And it's interesting that one of the first things that you talk about is that kind of taking, I think the heading is like taking a backseat in terms of sort of Disney. But it seems like the Flintstones marks this convergence of lots of different kind of threads. If you read about it through your work and people that have written on sort of primetime television animation and sort of one of the first, or the importance of the Flintstones in shaping this notion of a sitcom, the fact that it's this early example of quote-unquote adult animation, which is itself quite a fuzzy kind of category. So it seems like the Flintstones is this really important. So I guess my follow-up question is, are we saying that it's one of the first examples of this kind of program that has subsequently influenced quite a broad range of American, well, I suppose not just American, but beyond, that notion of an animated, so it is both one of the first or one of the most important adult animations, but it also set the template for kind of what we might understand as an animated sitcom as well.
Exactly. And I mean, we had adult animation before the Flintstones and the Looney Tunes, and many of those theatrical films focused on general audiences. Yeah. And I mean, if you watch some of those Looney Tunes, it is adult. I mean, the themes, but what the Flintstones did is brought those conventions to television while placing it in the structure of a sitcom, but also bringing that role of fantasy and role of kind of still rooting it in reality, but bringing kind of 20th century conventions into the prehistoric, while also bringing kind of the sitcom convention into animation. I mean, Jackie Gleason had considered suing because it, I mean, it, and that's as we get into some of the, especially the early episodes in the first two seasons, they're directly from Honeymooner storylines. And so that ability to leverage what live action cannot do while also using that format of the sitcom is really where the Flintstones stands alone. Although, as we'll discuss a little later on, they shifted their priorities, and that led to changes in the audience and changes in how it was marketed and kind of preface its eventual transition into Saturday morning.
Yeah.
We can come to the aesthetics very shortly, because you've given us three episodes to watch.
Yes.
As homework, as a kind of snapshot of the series history. And I hope we can talk about them as well as some other favourites of yours along the way. But staying on the, because your approach to this seems to be largely sort of economic and the kind of social economics of the show. What makes it, can we just spell out a little bit more about what makes it such an important show in that regard? I understand its sort of aesthetic legacy. We wouldn't get The Simpsons without it. We wouldn't get kind of this subgenre of animation without it. But what is important economically about the Flintstones as this kind of franchise, I guess, if you will?
So it helps Hanna-Barbera kind of find what its wheelhouse was going to be in the next, I can say 40 years, but I mean, it still exists in its legacy as a subsidiary of Warner. But ultimately, what kind of they would make their careers on, and understanding that with a lot of their content, it's not necessarily kind of longevity on television, and it's really about kind of the ancillary market, which they figured out in that third season, and it's also it was so far ahead of its time that there would not be another primetime animated sitcom on television for 23 years that people didn't quite see the economic value of it and didn't see that kind of with animation then becoming so associated with childhood because of the toys, because of the cereals, because of all the merchandising, people didn't think of adults buying the same stuff until another several decades later. And so I think it revealed the economic realities of animated television, and it also led them to really focus their energies on Saturday morning because it gave them more leeway, but also cost significantly less to produce those shows for the child audience. And when you look at all their shows, most of them only were in production for a season or two and just were rerun for 20, 30 years, which is why so many people remember the storylines, whereas the Flintstones has six seasons. And so that led to kind of a heightened desire for its syndication rights in Saturday morning, which, and it continues today, both on streaming platforms and on terrestrial television as well.
So let's dive into the show itself. As I say, we've got three episodes that we'll try and sort of use as kind of skimming stones over the river of the entire series. And nicely, to start us off, you've given us the pilot to watch. Or I don't know if it was commissioned as a pilot, but certainly the first ever.
So it wasn't. No. So there's actually a separate pilot that's a few minutes long. That's what they used to sell the networks.
Right.
And then it was not seen by the public until the 90s when it was played on Cartoon Network.
Really?
And that was when it was the... Yeah, and that's when there were the Flagstones.
Okay.
And then they changed the name because another property, High and Lois, had Flagstones on the show, and so they transitioned the name. And so there's a pilot, and then this is the first episode that
Fine.
I recommend.
Okay, so this is the first episode aired of the show. I normally make guests do the synopsis, but I feel I won't do that, given that you've curated an entire playlist for us. I guess the brief synopsis then is that we have a kind of classic sitcom, certainly classic 60s sitcom kind of hijinks. I don't know if this is taken from The Honeymooners or not, but it's Fred and Barney want to go bowling. Their wives want to take them to the opera because that's what wives like. And they concoct a plan where Fred kind of feigns illness so that they don't have to go to the opera and they can go bowling and participate in their tournament. And it all ends up in mirth and merriment and strange gadgets. It's an interesting episode. I found tonally, I think we can use this as a setup to talk about kind of early Flintstones and why it might differ from what people are, if people are particularly thinking of that Flintstones episode that they've got in their head and they're thinking about nostalgically. This isn't necessarily it. One thing, we don't have the iconic theme tune. We have a kind of version of it, but we don't get the kind of, you know, the dry through with the ribs that comes later. It's also quite episodic. I recognize, and there's like the first 5-10 minutes also almost runs like a kind of Roadrunner cartoon where Fred and Barney are running around the garden and Barney's invented some, we've basically invented a helicopter, but we'll squeeze over that. It's very domestic based. The wives are barely featured. It's mainly about these kind of two best friends. It's sort of Flintstones as you know them, but not quite as you know them, was sort of my take on it. Why, Jared, is this what is it particularly about the pilot that it sets up for kind of for the first couple of seasons that is worth us thinking about?
So I picked this episode because you can see them trying to find their footing as a show, and I think mentioning some of those Warner examples is important because Michael Maltese wrote the episode along with Joseph Barbera, and it's one of the few episodes Barbera actually writes that ended up Warren Foster, another Warner Brothers expat, eventually came over to Hanna-Barbera, and he kind of is seen as the soul, and his first episode would be the second episode, and he's seen as kind of the soul, and then him, Maltese, and Arthur Phillips become kind of the writing trio that create the adult version. And it's interesting that I feel those episodes are the best, but as you mentioned, it's not what people remember. It's really that third season where people remember the kind of the family dynamic and remember the theme song and things like that. But that first episode, you see it is a honeymooners plot, but it does add in elements that the honeymooners could never do, like the flying machine, along with kind of like in the episode, the way he breaks the 7-10 split is literally the ball breaking in half and splitting. But the bowling aspect, the friend hijinks, literally the two needing to be in two places at one time, is not only a honeymooner's plot, but becomes a plot in other episodes as well. And so you start seeing some setups, but you also still see kind of them relying on that classic show for those storylines. And so it's not quite the show we know, but there's still familiar elements that make it significant and popular. And I mean, the first episode, the numbers weren't great originally. It was about 7 million, which would be great now with the fragmented audience. But considering some of the later episodes are well in the 10, 15 millions. But you start seeing that growing audience by the next week. It's up to 8.25 million. And so it starts getting that groundswell because people appreciate the humor and the willingness of ABC to take a chance on the show because they're so desperate for content in some way to emerge out of kind of the shadow of the Big Two, which almost immediately rejected the show. But also kind of establishing Winston as a sponsor along with Miles Laboratory, which would follow the show along the rest of the time. But unsurprisingly, Winston would drop when it went into more of a family dynamic.
I had a question just very briefly before. I mean, I was so excited to when I was watching the episode, there were so many kind of different frameworks that I was trying to place the program in. And I'm excited to unpack all of those, but I genuinely had a question about, I was reading about the Winston cigarettes and how the characters were used in these adverts. It was making me think of a lot of recent work in animation about kind of animated advertising and kind of useful animation. And I was kind of half expecting to see, so were these adverts sort of tacked on the end of episodes? Were they just dotted around? Were they not connected to the episodes at all, and they just appeared, you know, these Flintstones characters selling and talking about cigarettes? Or were these, because I didn't really know this history, and so I was just wondering where, and then we'll get back to the episode, but the Winston's thing made me think, where, at what point, where would one see these Flintstones characters advertising these cigarettes? Before, after, during?
So it would be during the show. I mean, it was mimicking the commercials you would see. I mean, you would have single sponsor shows, and these shows, I mean, obviously we went into having more kind of traditional interstitial commercials to kind of remove and separate the advertisers from the program. But they would appear kind of as interstitials. And so they would kind of end the scene, and then they would have the one of the famous commercials. It's Barney and Fred sitting while the Betty is cleaning a rug by beating it with a bat, and then Wilma is mowing the lawn, and they're like, "We're so tired of watching our wives work. Let's go have a cigarette." And there'd be other commercials that also featured Wilma as well, but they would. That's what other shows would do, that kind of you would have on set, you have the actors with the product advertising it, and it's always showing it to students and things like that. One, they're surprised to have even seen a tobacco advertisement, let alone one on a commercial. But also kind of the Winston hack is so, like, they it looks live action, and so you have a cartoon and they're holding the cigarette is like the size of their arm, the cigarette box. And so it's kind of this interesting juxtaposition. It looked very similar to a live action advert that you would see during a traditional sitcom of that era.
Yeah. Well, no, I was going to try and unpack. I guess I'm really just still obsessed with this helicopter. Just to clarify for listeners who haven't watched this episode, if they have, go and watch it. So it's a sort of plot point at the beginning of the episode. It's the sort of first, I don't know, act, if not half of the episode. Barney builds this kind of rudimentary flying device, and they use it later to kind of get to the bowling alley on time and get back. Things like that, just so people don't think I've gone completely mad. But I guess what I'm interested in is there's this whole thing in the Flintstones. I guess there are two narratives about the Flintstones people might often cite that I'm trying to reconcile before we even get going here. Maybe it's not something we can reconcile. And that's the approach it takes to kind of technology. And I guess on the one hand, we could say that despite the fact that this is a cartoon set in prehistoric America, it's really a show set in the sort of late 50s, early 60s. It's basically the Honeymooners, and it's using animation to have fun with the setting, but really it's just a sort of sitcom dressed up in these other clothes. And we could go down a rabbit hole that I'm very happy for us to go down around the way it kind of uses its therefore kind of fantastical animated structure kind of to spectacularize everyday life, right? It's got, you know, it's got the dishwasher that's actually some sort of animal. And actually what that really does is make us marvel at the kind of power of the dishwasher, and same with the vacuum cleaner and things like that. So on one hand, technology is, the show's about just everyday technology. But on the other hand, within 2 minutes of getting into this sitcom, we've got a character inventing this kind of amazing flying gadget, which doesn't seem to me like kind of route one. If I was like, okay, right, episode one, everyone, writers team, pitch me an idea for this kind of sitcom set in prehistoric America. I know one of the cavemen invent a flying machine. So at the same time, it's very interested in the kind of fantasy of technology. And in a way, you know, well, that is, you know, we can get back to what animation might do in that role. So I guess I'm riffing here on the role technology plays in the series overall, or on the kind of display of technology. Because in a way, this is a show that is interested in these kind of sci-fi, fantastical, turn this gear, this cog will go this way, this thing, and we can achieve things we would never achieve in real life, but is also very much interested in real life and everyday domestic spaces at the same time. I guess I'm not very satisfied with either narrative, which is why I'd like your thoughts, Jared. Like, I don't think it's not just the Honeymooners animated. It's very interested in these kind of fantastical spaces it can create because it is animated.
Yeah, and I think that's where they're kind of, again, where they're trying to find their footing a little bit. And they do, and then again, just kind of, you start seeing the formula come a little later in the season when you do have the normal sitcom storyline, but then the almost vaudevillian jokes from the devices, many of which are living animals. Mm-hmm. And again, there's no kind of, I don't want to say no continuity, but sometimes they drive with their feet. Sometimes they're getting gas for an engine, but the engine doesn't actually exist. And that's kind of the whole thing with Hanna-Barbera is just they have no kind of, whereas you have others Wile E. Coyote is a perfect example where they had a checklist of, okay, these are the rules that exist in this world. Whereas Hanna-Barbera is like, whatever plays, like, it doesn't matter if in the previous episode, they're using this animal as a dishwasher, we can use them now as a car horn or whatever. And as you pointed out, you also see where it's separating itself from the Honeymooners. The Honeymooners is a very urban environment, whereas this is clearly suburban sprawl. This is exemplifying what was going on in terms of where people were living, where the viewers were ultimately moving to, at least the viewers that they were trying to attract. And it's also kind of in an interesting way, although they kind of take it a little kind of to another level with the Jetsons, looking at the impact it has on kind of our domestic lives, and changing kind of the way, and especially kind of the increase in leisure time because of these devices, and the increase in kind of the role of, or the evolution of the homemaker. Mm. We kind of briefly touched upon kind of it goes headfirst into gender roles. I mean, they're not kind of, a little later on, you see Wilma get a job and things like that. But for the most part, a lot of the comedy, even in this episode, is around those gender dynamics. As you pointed out, kind of only women can like the opera and all men hate the opera and they want a bowl instead. And so, but they need to keep the wife happy. And so they're going to go, but then put on fake mustaches and fly their flying machine, which, and again, the episode is a little bit clunky, as you pointed out, because they invent this flying machine and then they also have to deal with the domestic bliss around going out with their wives and keeping them happy, but also they're like, oh wait, we have this flying machine, let's use it to trick them and go bowling instead. And they would have, and it's also that thing, they would have gotten away with it if Barney just took his mustache off.
If they hadn't realized that the bowling alley is across the road from the opera. I mean, that's one hell of a street.
exactly. You don't know, there could have been a T-Rex or something and they needed to get away from it. But ultimately, I think you do see some of this conflict in the first several episodes of like, what are we going to be? And again, they still rely, especially in that first season, heavily on kind of the conventions. And it's not just storylines. The Honeymooners created a number of sitcom conventions that continue today, that there's still plenty of shows that still do the two places at one time episodes. There's plenty of shows that, I mean, even if you look at a show, I know it's over 20 years old, but like King of Queens, I mean, so many of those storylines are from the Flintstones along with Simpsons storylines. And I was watching the second episode too. And you have, Barney on a trampoline, and that exact scene was seen in The Simpsons when he got the free trampoline from Krusty. And then his children are seeing him bounce up and down. They're like, what's going on? And then that becomes kind of a larger joke. And of course, someone needs to fall off the trampoline. Otherwise, it's not funny. But ultimately, it's trying to be a few things at once during that kind of first several episodes until they figured out what it was going to be. And that led to a lot of success.
Yeah. So we should probably move on, and moving on, we're skipping all of season two, the rest of season one, and most of season three. So perhaps we can fill in the gaps as we go. But we're jumping to a sort of a midpoint episode, and it's an obvious one to pick, Jared, but it's a really important one to pick, which is, so we have the birth of Pebbles, now there's lots of titles for this episode. It came up for me as Blessed Event, but it's also called something else, isn't it? It's
Dress Rehearsal,
right. Yeah. But I'm going to call it the Birth of Pebbles episode. And the plot, very simply, is that, Wilma and Fred's daughter is born. But of course, born through a variety of different mistaken identities, hijinks getting to and from the hospital, Fred accidentally taking Barney accidentally taking Fred accidentally taking Dino at one point to the hospital before eventually their daughter is born.
Well, I was going to say, every episode needs a birth episode. All my favourite sitcoms, from Scrubs to Friends to even my favourite ever programme is Only Fools and Horses from...
It's a very UK-centric reference.
Very famously, a lot of writers in the UK context have said, well, we now cannot write a birth scene because this programme kind of did the quintessential birth scene for kind of UK audiences. But there's always this kind of scene, it feels like. And so this, and you, I think when you set it up for us, Jared, you said this is sort of kind of a key moment, but also maybe where the program starts to shift, kind of shifts in its tone. And you alluded to it earlier when you said up to this point, it wasn't really, it didn't really have the same kind of family dynamics. So this is a pivotal episode.
It is. And so I guess to kind of, I mean, this was a long process, but part of it was that they did notice, again, even though it was geared to an adult audience, they had a significant teenage and even younger audience, and families were watching it. And so they wanted to, they started to lean into that, but also recognizing and why, because actually when the show was originally conceptualized, they did have a son. And then they're like, and then they kind of went, took a step back and say, wait, no, we want this to be an adult sitcom and not kind of too childish, because they thought that would undermine kind of their legitimacy. And then the merchandising consideration came along, and they're originally going to have a son, and they're like, wait, boys don't buy dolls, so let's have a girl instead. And so Pebbles was conceptually born, and then later in the season was actually born. And it dramatically changes show. And this is what kind of those last three seasons are what is most remembered, because they're the ones that played most on Saturday morning, because it was a little more juvenile in the humor and in its approach with Pebbles, and then Bam Bam coming the next season. But that third season is when the classic song came along, partly to separate it from Looney Tunes, which is using a very similar song to what they're using the first two seasons for their theme song. My argument in the book is that they leaned a little too much into that. That teenagers and even children like watching stuff that's older than them, that's geared toward older audiences. And the show lasted three more seasons, and was still in the top 30 up until the last season, but it changed the humor, and the writers changed as well to reflect that. And so this new direction, and it being at the end of the third season, was fully felt in the fourth season, with it being kind of more, less honeymooners and more, I don't want to say Leave It to Beaver, but that kind of show where it was like, oh shucks, we're a family, like, versus like, again, Fred and Barney trying to figure out ways to drink with their lodge and ways to go bowling and kind of these other more outlandish adult situations.
I wonder if a comparison made here. So your thesis sounds like it's that the kind of the first three are real Flintstones, to make your argument as caricatured and simplistic as possible. And then in the sort of, this is the pivot towards a slightly more cutesier, broader Flintstones that actually has survived the cultural memory. So if I think about, like, kind of, you know, the Flintstones live action film, it's very much a post this episode kind of Flintstones they're adapting. But actually I guess the interesting comparison with that would be like, you know, what happened with The Simpsons, right? Which is that everyone thought the star of The Simpsons was going to be Bart, because they would sell the most merchandise and would be the coolest, and that would be who all the kids tune in to see. But by what, season 2-3, they realize it's Homer.
And actually while I was writing this book, I had an academic paper looking at those third seasons, and the Flintstones kind of undermining their established audience by going that direction, where it almost seemed like The Simpsons learned from that and went the opposite direction and actually said, Homer is the longer lasting character if we want this audience that is not going to grow out of our product.
What was the outcome, or what was the effect of that shift on the dynamic between the adults? Because this episode, I tried to jot down a couple of Well, this episode features a couple of killer lines, such as another wife, what are you, an Arabian prince? And boy, has he got to got his women trained. So there was just a couple of interesting lines that I thought. But did the shift kind of have an effect on the dynamic, the kind of the domesticated roles of the women? I mean, is there a shift in the way that the gender roles or the relationship between the adults, is that impacted by that turn after series 3?
So, I mean, Fred and Barney, I changed the most in terms of, I mean, Fred becomes less volatile. Right. And I mean, he's still kind of reactionary, but he's kind of a little more, I don't want to say calmer, but a little more kind of measured. And then Barney is kind of a little less of a trickster and a little less snarky,
right,
and more kind of domestic. And so I think, as you pointed out, it becomes kind of a softer dynamic between all of them. It's still kind of the, as we again still see in many sitcoms, the smart wife who is the one who's kind of in control, and kind of the husband trying to get away with things, and trying to kind of get what he wants, often by lying or often kind of doing things behind the scenes. But there's more kind of family storylines as well, in terms of we're taking Pebbles to the park, or we're part of the we're engaging with what was the Boy Scouts, the prehistoric version of the Boy Scouts and things like that, which was interesting because they had nations that they're prehistoric, but there's a contingency from Mexico.
Sure.
And it's like, well, let's skip over colonization and then just again, these nations must have always existed. But it does take a softer tone, and I think that leads to many adults saying, I'm going to watch something that more speaks to my kind of comedic sensibilities, and younger audiences continue to watch. But again, a lot of those cultural memories are the fact that it was replayed on Saturday morning over and over and over again on every network for several decades.
Just before we get to the final episode that you've selected, I was also interested in actually what had stayed the same between the first episode that you asked us to watch and then this one, sort of at roughly the midpoint. So the design, I mean, the kind of design of the characters, I'd noted down, again, some of the aesthetic frameworks that you could place the program in. So, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, Dan Bashara's work on kind of UPA, and that sort of modernist style, the suggestion of there's enough in the background without kind of hyper realist detail to give the suggestion of sort of setting and landscape and so forth. And then actually something that we've definitely talked about is kind of Chris Pallant's work on the composition, what he calls the compositional looseness of Disney films of this period, particularly 101 Dalmatians, which is right at the start of when this program, so that's 61, so only a year after the Flintstones. And he's talking specifically about the impact of that Xerox technology on the look of Disney films in this particular period. And he talks about colour not quite reaching the edge. So there are these quite definitive black outlines, but the actual colour themselves doesn't quite reach the edge, or in some cases spills over the edge. And I kind of saw both sort of in play a little bit throughout, especially I think the design of the backdrops, so and the sort of stone walls. And I think there's a bit at some point, I think it's when Fred goes into the hospital bed to kind of see Wilma, and there are colours that just seem to extend beyond the actual objects that are being represented. So I thought that was really interesting, that there's a sort of consistency, and I quite like mapping, because with Tom and Jerry and The Simpsons, there are certain seasons that you can you like, that looks like season 3, 4 of The Simpsons. That's the 8th, that's clearly that. And same with Tom and Jerry, the way that kind of, depending on who was sort of directing, the Chuck Jones films are very different to the kind of Gene Deitch films and so forth. So I just, that I thought was interesting, that consistency, maybe less so in the final episode. I thought there was a little bit more refinement, but that certainly felt like it was kind of staying the same. And also the opening of this dress rehearsal episode, the Blessed Event episode, you get the familiar opening, and I've written definitely inspired. He's more like Homer Simpson, but also the range of characters, because the opening, if I remember, takes place in a gym. The opening in a gym, and you have lots and lots of different characters. And it starts to kind of flesh out the other inhabitants of the world. And also, this was, having done a bit of Googling to make myself look like I know what I'm talking about, this is the last of a four-episode story arc relating to the birth of Pebbles. Yep. So this is a really interesting. There are these overarching stories that seem to extend across multiple episodes. But I thought that was, I thought it was a really interesting episode. I thought Barney assuming the role of Wilma was, I mean, there's lots to say about gender, which we haven't got time to say, but I like the, I'm trying to act like Wilma. Okay. So we could do a bit of, hey, all renditions of gender in animation are performative, but we haven't got time to do that. But I thought it was a kind of pivot point. I could definitely see what this was doing, especially in relation to the last episode, where I think in the email that certainly Alex sent me about what we were doing, he was like, this is jumping the shark moment.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the art is extremely important, that as you pointed out, very kind of artistic... kind of 60s sensibility, yeah, as you pointed out with UA, and also I think it's important kind of in the larger scheme, and this is where kind of the influence comes in, with like shows like South Park, where the realization where like you don't need to be Disney to tell a story. No. You don't need that kind of, and again, I think also pointing out kind of some of the compromises Disney was making in the 60s is reflected. And I mean, 101 Dalmatians is, obviously, many people love that movie, but you see some of those artistic compromises creeping in, to movies like that. But with a show like the Flintstones, it's a realization that people aren't going to watch it week to week. And this is with Hanna-Barbera's entire catalog. For the artistry, they're watching for the comedy, and it's really kind of just a vehicle for the comedy. And then the South Park guys figure that out even harder, being like, we're going to cut out circles, and it's going to be kind of the idea that it's third graders saying this stuff. And then they kind of have founded multiple footings throughout the year to kind of have the show remain irreverent, but focus kind of differently politically, but as you pointed out again, that last episode is also kind of where we start seeing the Saturday morning kind of version of not only the Flintstones but kind of their entire catalog, which a couple years later, what many consider their kind of most popular character would debut in Scooby-Doo. But it's significant that the creators of Scooby-Doo would form their own studio and create their other kind of iconic characters within that. But I think this third season, and this is kind of also that archery as well, we're also seeing, along with kind of the Honeymooners influence, the Warner Brothers influence, with the amount of expats from Warner Brothers who is cutting their staff and cutting their production, made their way, and Hanna-Barbera's like, come along, like, we'd love to have you. And you see a lot of the same artistry in the Wile E. Coyote, with the kind of the Western background, as you would see in the Flintstones, along with the writers coming along as well. And then in this transitionary period, you have what is more kind of family sitcom writers join the staff and be part of that transition. And so, animation is a very insular world.
Yeah.
And you see the influences transition from one company to another. And I mean, again, as you pointed out with Tom and Jerry, we see that the later versions of when Hanna-Barbera were not involved in Tom and Jerry look very different, but be very similar to Warner Brothers at that time. And then there are kind of parallels to the artistry that ended up there, because they're all bouncing around companies trying to find a stable home. Because as you pointed out too, Disney was struggling to really find a regular footing because they no longer had shorts. And so you would have the people working on the full-length films, but there's people that wanted to work on short comedic films and had made their careers on those types of content. And the only people that were really doing that content were Hanna-Barbera and then Filmation and the other TV animation companies that would eventually come along, including Ruby Spears. And so that artistry thing, I think, is really important to recognize in this era animation. And even though Warner Brothers were producing some television animation, particularly for their Looney Tunes show, a lot of what was the classic Looney Tunes would find its way into the Hanna-Barbera cartoons.
Interesting. And I quite like, I mean, for my two cents, I kind of prefer the earlier, because as you watch the three episodes, and we'll get onto the final in a second, that they're kind of stylistic. It becomes less loose, right? It becomes more, I'm assuming, just the budget goes up or the filmmaking arsenal goes up, so they've got more sets to draw from, all the kind of stuff that makes it cheaper to do and more efficient to do. But I kind of prefer that kind of elasticity. It plays better. I mean, for me, you know, the fun bits of the Flintstones are where the kind of the absurdity of everything is kind of highlighted on screen, and that kind of formal looseness, as you've said, helps with that, you know. I think I'd find the outdated gender politics, the various stuff like that, far less abrasive in this format than kind of just watching The Honeymooners, because there's this tone of absurdity, of grotesqueness to everything, you know. And everyone seems as ridiculous as everyone else on some occasions, to where point the kind of the soft politics of it seem to just sort of fall apart with the kind of color palette of it all. So I quite like all that, and kind of, yeah, kind of the more absurd the better. That being said, we have to talk about the final episode. Well, the final episode you've shown us, and the kind of the jumping the shark moment. And I suspect even listeners who have only a passing knowledge of the Flintstones will know what we're about to talk about, which is the kind of the infamous moment where I guess we're coming to the end point in the story of at least the initial six season run. I've done the first two synopses, but I am going to make you do the last one, Jared, because I'm not going to attempt to unearth what's going on here. But this is obviously the arrival of the Great Gazoo. What happens here?
I also feel bad because the voice of Gazoo is Harvey Korman, who's an incredible comedian, but I don't have a character I hate more than Gazoo. It so changes the dynamic of the show. And so ultimately, again, and this harkens back to the first episode, that Wilma and Betty want to go to an expensive restaurant. And so they must take their wives out. They can't afford it, but all of a sudden they come upon a spaceship. And even the voice of Gazoo in the spaceship seems out of place automatically. Oh, first, like having an alien, especially since Jetsons had been on for a couple years. You're like, where is this actually, like, why? That it wasn't kind of anything inventive because they already had a future-focused show. But basically, Gazoo is punished for being too much of a trickster. And so he's both sent to Earth and sent back in time to prehistoric age as a punishment. And he has to prove himself by basically serving Barney and Fred. And so he appears in a number of episodes kind of in this last portion of the run. But part of it was kind of similar to, obviously you have the Happy Days Jumping the Shark, but it's almost kind of a Cousin Oliver situation with the Brady Bunch, where it's like, okay, things are getting stale, let's introduce a new character. But the new character just does not fit at all. But and then there's multiple storylines about him helping Barney and Fred through wishes and through kind of granting, and ultimately he promises to give him money, but then Gazoo in his laziness just doesn't show up when they're calling him to pay the bill, and they have to wash dishes, which again, there's these common kind of sitcom tropes which is interrupted by this character that just, again, I mean, no matter how much I watch it, I just cannot. I mean, I understand the reasoning, but I still cannot make sense of his involvement in the Flintstones world.
I mean, I have nothing to add beyond the. My first thought was Gazoo cannot be a returning character, and of course that's kind of what happened. But I wrote that it kind of disrupts the laws of the world because you have kind of invisibility and gravity and this sort of genie-like character which seems to be a very handy. Basically, it's the equivalent of the Room of Requirement in the Harry Potter movies, where you need something to. Right, we really need like a plot hole that needs to be resolved. Oh, we'll just sort that out. So I guess from a genre perspective, it's quite interesting because it sort of plays with, you know, it's I don't know what it's doing. It's fantasy coming in, Alex, and ruining it for everybody. But I guess I don't really have anything other than disrupting the laws of the world. I did notice at the start that this is the episode where Fred is speaking to the audience a bit more. So I guess there's a kind of increased flexibility to the episode that maybe is a symptom of the fact it's the final season. But yeah, beyond what you said, I think it's such an interesting leap to make, and interesting that's the leap that it took into a different kind of register of fantasy, let's say.
I don't mind it. I think
rubbish.
I think to say that it's the problem is certainly, I think the problem with it is not that it breaks the laws of the world. I don't know what the problem with it is. There is something wrong, but I think we were talking about the coherence of the world. I wanted to challenge that at some point because I actually think there's something delightfully incoherent about Bedrock that makes it so pleasurable. Like I made that gag when we did the first episode that it happens that the bowling alley is next to the opera house, and then in the third episode they were at a gym. Because of course Fred would go to a gym, and they have a lot of fun with the kind of weird contraptions at the gym. Then the person that runs the gym is actually being like inflated by water, or is it air from an elephant or a woolly mammoth and things like that. So actually the gym doesn't really make any sense either. And I suspect if I watched other episodes, the bowling alley would move around all over the place and things like that. And in The Simpsons, these are gaffes that the kind of eventually they just kind of go with and accept. In this, it feels willfully defiant. There's an anarchic energy that, Jared, you articulated earlier, that whatever works, we just go with it. So I sort of don't really care or mind that sometimes he can give them flowers and pay their bill, but sometimes he can't, and he just appears out of nowhere and all that kind of stuff. I don't really mind all that. I think there is something tonally just really weird about it, isn't it? There's something about... I don't know if it's narrative agency, you know, these kind of supernatural beings that come in and kind of take control of the narrative and take control of the cause and effect chain of the narrative means that Barney doesn't have to dress up like Wilma anymore or Fred doesn't have to pretend to have a headache anymore. Things can just be kind of clicked and magicked into being. And I think the voice performance, and it is kind of, it's full on and it's fun in its own terms, but it doesn't seem to fit with the kind of more gravelly, pun intended, kind of register of the rest of the characters. So I have a tonal problem with Gazoo, but as the resident fantasist, there's nothing wrong with the fantasy of it. It makes sense within a world that deliberately doesn't make any sense, you know, in a world where we have French waiters and Mexican delegates in a prehistoric nationless world, we may as well have a space alien. You know, that's the least of the problem we've got.
And I mean, I think that's fair. I mean, I don't think like the idea was like automatically set to fail the issue. I mean, I think the voice thing is significant. Again, I think Corman is a fantastic comedic actor on Carol Burnett and a number of other shows. But he even admits, he's like, I'm in this room with all these incredible voice actors and I'm kind of just there. And he admits it in later interviews. He's just like, I did what I thought like a weird green alien would sound like, and it doesn't quite fit with the rest of the voice cast. But I mean, I think part of it is too that it is this, and they already kind of were going down that road in again, with the introduction of Pebbles, especially in the fifth season, that kind of, it really went that childish kind of direction. And so he does fit with other Hanna-Barbera productions, but so many people saw Flintstones as separate from their kind of Saturday morning output, whereas Gazoo represents that Saturday morning output. And so people felt like those kind of child shows had fully invaded the Flintstones, that it already started with Pebbles, then was increased with Bam Bam, and was increased with the storylines in the fifth and sixth seasons. I think another issue is, I think he's incredibly unlikable, and not just in interactions with and he's purposefully supposed to be kind of not likable, but like it goes beyond kind of just being like he's disruptive to, oh God, like, are they going to call on him again? Especially since he doesn't appear in every episode after he debuts. You're just like, is this storyline going to be them calling on Gazoo and then kind of going in a totally different direction? And this is not just like retroactively, he was disliked then. I mean, NBC refused to play his episodes when they got the original syndication rights in 1967. And they're just like, we're not going to play those episodes because people don't like, we don't want to remember like Gazoo existing. And then he would appear in the cereal commercials when Pebbles cereal debuted in 1971. He was a character with the vitamins that debuted in 68, which is significant as well. Those are part of people's memories of the Flintstones, and they became products after the show was off the ended its original production run, but his appearance in those commercials shows what was the mindset of introducing him. But for me, kind of as someone who so holds so dearly those first two seasons and even third and fourth seasons, that was kind of the punch in the face, being like, this is not the show that you fell in love with anymore, and here's this giant headed green reminder of that show that you used to love.
Okay, so that's enough Gazoo bashing, but worth doing it. Okay, so it sounds like we're at the end of our story in terms of the show. So it kind of, it sounds like we've kind of dealt with it, but it ends on primetime first run, but it survives in syndication. I suspect to this day, it's been a while since I've checked out Cartoon Network, but last time I did, these sort of things still popped up here and there, right? And of course, all the other kind of franchise efforts that we've alluded to, I'm sure we could name many, many more besides. Is there anything we need to cover about the Flintstones? Any final notes that we've got? Before we talk about Jared's other work, Chris.
No, well, I only have one from that middle episode, which I forgot to mention, which was the presence of the two caricatures at the hospital, who a bit of googling tells me is Vince Edwards and Sam Jaffe from a medical drama, and it reminded me of the writing that's kind of been done about Warner Brothers and basically a lot of non-Disney studios that lean into caricature, and there's a particular kind of culture of caricature. So I thought that was just a really interesting moment, that there's a sort of an intertextual reference outwards to the current current state of American television.
That's interesting. Did the Flintstones do like guest stars much? Is that okay?
Yes, right, a lot. Okay. Yeah, and they all had funny, punny names. Right. But they use the voices, and an episode that follows the Gazoo episode features a live band playing, and again they have as I do a quick search of the actual band that appears, they would bring in these, and really the Simpsons does a ton of that, of bringing the actual voices of the guest, that, and sometimes they do it where it's not the guest and they're kind of making fun of the person, but that use of kind of the current Hollywood and bringing in characters and bringing in actual actors as a draw to that episode, this person's going to appear or their voice is going to appear, is significant. A part of what makes the Flintstones kind of that popular is that it was speaking to contemporary culture through the celebrities they brought in. And so that was pretty common throughout the series and appeared fairly early on. And even kind of they had an episode where Samantha from Bewitched appears, which is significant too, because they animated the opening theme for Bewitched. Similar, and that's how they got into television, by animating I Love Lucy and their opening theme. And so I think their kind of relationships to television is something they jumped right into. And even kind of the following episode, I guess it was two episodes after Gazoo, like they're selling pies to Safestone supermarkets, which was actually a parody of Safeway.
Right.
And so they were fully kind of embracing what was going on, but again, with those incredible prehistoric rock-based puns to make sure that we knew it was still located in Bedrock or one of the towns surrounding it, because actually Barney's not even from Bedrock. He's from the neighboring town.
I always like to try and prize animation away from Chris's lot. So it's you could almost do a whole version of this where you don't mention its place within animation history, but you talk about its place within these, you know, Bewitched, I Dream of Jeannie, The Addams Family, these kind of 50s, 60s domestic sitcoms using fantasy and horror and sci-fi tropes to say something about the kind of emergence of the suburban middle class family, and this one fits right within it. So it's interesting that it's even got, you know, the two mains from Bewitched turning up in it. Yeah, fascinating. Right. So I guess that's the Flintstones done. It's so not the Flintstones done, but it was really nice to talk through it and give it some time. Jared, thanks so much for doing that with us. So yes, you've got a book about Hanna-Barbera more broadly. Talk us through, and you've got some other projects on the way. Talk listeners through what else would be in the book if they're interested in purchasing it, which is available now, and then what else you've got coming up in your kind of wider academics field, because I know you've got a kind of broader field of interest than just animation history and its economics.
And so the book, proud that I mentioned, and again, some of these shows were pilots that didn't air and things like that, but I mentioned every single one of their productions, from Tom and Jerry through the establishment of Cartoon Network. And so being able to kind of touch upon, and a lot of those kind of are lost in history, and their attempts to do live action sitcoms, their attempts to do some more feature length films, which they had a little bit of success. I mean, but often it would come later, like with Charlotte's Web, which is kind of a classic animated feature film for many, but it didn't really become popular until film rentals, that it was kind of lost in its original premiere in theaters. And all of a sudden, parents found it, and with the connection, the deep kind of emotional connection people had with the book, they're happy to forward that through the film version to their children. But just looking at kind of their evolution, and also recognizing kind of the context, as you pointed out, of what else was going on, that we see kind of, especially with animated shows, some of the kind of the technological issues, like you mentioned with early Simpsons, you can see kind of when it airs, but animation ages much more gracefully than its live action counterpart. So people forget kind of what else was going on. And even teaching about these things, like remembering that kind of when Scooby-Doo debuted, we're dealing with civil rights and we're dealing with women's liberation, which is part of the push to have more female characters and eventually female leads. You also have their few entrances into having black animated characters, which didn't occur until 1970. And so you see the evolution, these influences that, unlike Disney, which has tried to kind of at least historically remained a little more isolated from those issues and be like, we're still kind of rooted in Disney's version of Americana. Hanna-Barbera is like, no, this is what's going on in the world. Our humor is going to be topical. Our humor is going to be evolve with what's going on, and going from kind of the suburban suburbanization reflecting the Flintstones and Jetsons to more kind of teenager hippiness in Scooby-Doo and their 70s programming. The book kind of looks at that evolution and also their adaptations, and really the longest running show is the Smurfs, and obviously they did not create those characters. And so how they kind of also evolved their viewpoints and evolved their business as well by embracing the importance of merchandising and reboots, along with their adaptive nature of their program, and what it meant to kind of the revitalization of television animation in the late 80s, early 90s. Hanna-Barbera is a part of that. And when you look at shows like Johnny Bravo and Two Stupid Dogs and that era of Cartoon Network, they're involved in those shows, and a lot of that influence is still seen today. I mean, Seth MacFarlane started with Hanna-Barbera on Dexter's Laboratory, and then you see some of that humor, and he's a student of Hanna-Barbera and other older cartoons, and you see that reflected in Family Guy. And so their legacy is still remains today. And as kind of we see occasional rumors about a live action Flintstones reboot, the disappointment in Scoob 2 being canceled, but Tom and Jerry and Scoob and these other shows or other films still appearing along with their kind of syndication on Max and other platforms shows kind of their foresight in terms of what animation can be long term, and how kind of it's about kind of the emotional connection the audience has, and not necessarily being kind of the overwhelming artistic groundbreaking that Disney was and continues to be in certain aspects.
Yeah, and certainly I think Hanna-Barbera and the book kind of articulates this, and I mentioned this briefly at the start, that, you know, the animation scholarship and animation history has its sort of favorite sons, and it's certainly there needs to be an equivalent to something like the Disney studies of the 90s on Warner Brothers and Hanna-Barbera and all these other kind of studios that have really shaped kind of American culture and the relationship between animation and America. So yes, I will put a link to the book and people should go out and...
Terrific. And before we let you go, you have an upcoming project that you're happy to tease us with.
So right now I'm finishing up some work on and speaking to animation as a global platform. I also do sports studies work, and so looking at the globalization of both the NFL and the National Basketball Association, and then getting back to my Hanna-Barbera roots, looking at their use of other media, including literature, TV shows, and film, to adapt and create new shows, and that kind of attention to the adaptive nature of media in general, which all platforms have now embraced, something that Hanna-Barbera utilized to quicken the familiarity with the characters and connecting with the audience. And so I'm working on kind of finishing up that. And then the chapter on globalization should be out later this year as
Terrific.
Well.
Terrific. Do encourage readers to check, readers, well, our listeners, future readers, to check those works out. And yeah, other than that, Jared, thank you so much for talking through the Flintstones with us. It was a real pleasure.
No, I appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate all of you looking at this content, both in terms of fantasy and in terms of animation. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Pleasure's all ours. we are on we're on the internet, fancy-animation.org. You can find our previous blog posts. Have we got anything on Hanna-Barbera or the Flintstones on the back catalogue?
No, we haven't. Not really. No.
Budding scholars, PhD students, master's students, academics who just really want to write some more stuff, get in touch with Chris via the Contact Us tab. We'd like to hear some pitches. Otherwise, you can find the whole back catalogue there. You can follow us on Instagram, whatever it's called, all of them. You can follow it at FananIm Research, FananIm Research, and we'll be there to talk to you there. And you can also use that same handle at gmail.com to send suggestions for future footnote episodes. And we're about to record one of them right now, which you'll hear in a week's time. Otherwise, we'll see you on a future episode or a past episode. Either way, we'll see you there.
Bye.